CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Our top story, two British civilians working for NATO were among those killed in Saturday's terrorist attack in Afghanistan's capital. Colonel Peter Daw of the Canadian Command says one of their soldiers, Master Corporal Byron Greff, was also killed.
He was traveling in an International Security Assistance Force convoy at the time of the attack. Along with our fallen Canadian, we mourn the loss of other coalition soldiers, Afghan police officers, and Afghan civilians.
We're still not sure how many Americans were killed in the attack. Tensions are high again in the Middle East after 10 people were killed in Gaza and southern Israel Saturday. CNN's Kevin Flower says things are quiet for now.
With the help of Egypt, a ceasefire has been brokered between the Islamic Jihad group. It's saying that it will abide by the ceasefire, but that it retains, quote, the right to resist as Israel continues its strikes.
Qantas says there will be no flights until midday Monday at the earliest. Tens of thousands of travelers around the world are affected by a labor dispute at the Australian airline. The power could be off for days for some people on the East Coast. A rare October snowstorm knocked out the electricity to millions of customers. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says it's hard for the power crews to get around.
You just cannot get the trees off the road fast enough. We're getting those tree crews out there with the power companies. But that's the biggest problem. And, you know, you have probably 25 state roads completely closed right now.
Many people are camped out at airports because of canceled flights. Penn State's Joe Paterno is now the winningest coach in college football. Victory number 409 was a dramatic 10-7 win over Illinois. Paterno passed Eddie Robinson with the most wins in Division I history. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
Hey, it's Mike Rowe talking about the big tire event with Fiona, who works at a Ford dealership. How are you, Fiona?
I'm good, thank you.
What makes the big tire event big?
Everything.
Selection?
Big.
Rebates?
Big.
Savings?
Big.
It's big all around.
All around, it's big.
It's so large, in fact, that the announcer should take it from here.
Buy four select tires, get a $100 rebate, and that's on top of the low price tire guarantee.
All right, well, there it is. It's a big tire event, and everything about it is
big. Competitors ad required for tire guarantee. Stop by any participating Ford dealer or visit FordOwner.com for rebate details through 11/30/11.
Hey everybody, Jay Farner here, and I'd like to introduce the Yorgage from Quicken Loans. Our Yorgage is better than a traditional mortgage because it conforms to your goals. It's a fixed-rate home loan that allows you to custom design a term that works best for you, anywhere from 8 to 30 years. The rate today on an 8-year fixed Yorgage is an amazing 3.5%, APR 3.69%. Call today at 800-970-2611.
Call us for cost information. Other restrictions may apply. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
Taking a family of five to the amusement park can cost a small fortune.
Oh, yeah. So to save some money, we thought, hey, let's bring the amusement park to us.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. Step right up. Step right up, young man. Are you ready to ride the Wacky Waterfall?
That's just the bathtub with the shower head running.
Nope, it's the Wacky Waterfall.
It's the shower, Dad.
Waterfall.
Wacky.
There's an easier way to save. Get online. Go to Geico.com. Get a quote. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Hi, welcome to Best Buy. Can I help you?
Yeah, my brother got an Insignia HD Radio Portable last month, and he really enjoys his workouts now.
Yep, HD Radio broadcasts are great. All kinds of new stuff on the HD2, HD3 channels.
And the Insignia HD Radio Portable is $49.99?
Yes, it's a great value.
Whoa, lead the way.
And did you know Insignia also offers an HD Radio Boombox for just $99?
Insignia HD Radio receivers. Get them now at Best Buy. HD Radio. More radio, more value.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest, Doug Smith, who's a partner with B2B CFO, the world's largest CFO firm. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, the full-service law firm in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
IT Professionals, the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council's Academy, is a unique interactive training and education program designed specifically for the federal IT community, both government and industry. Courses in leadership, best practices, and project management start soon, so don't wait. Register today at www.actgov.org/academy. That's www.actgov.org/academy.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. And I'm joined by my co-hosts, Michael Ankuma of the Bank of America, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems. And we've got a great lineup of guests for you today, including Dr. Ellen Siegel, chairperson and founder of Friends of Cancer Research, with Jerry Siegel, her husband, who is the chairman, owner, and founder of Siegel Construction. We also have Sanu Singh, founder and CEO of 1901 Group, and Renee Lewis, president and CEO of Pensar Group. And I'd like to introduce you to and welcome our first guests today, Dr. Ellen Siegel, who's the chairperson and founder of Friends of Cancer Research, and Jerry Siegel, chairman, owner, and founder of Siegel Construction. Welcome, Ellen. Welcome, Jerry. And Jerry, we're going to start with you. What is Siegel Construction?
Siegel Construction is a general contractor based in Washington, D.C., that builds commercial, institutional, and does a lot of work for the federal government.
And you've been around for how long, Jerry?
We just celebrated our 35th year on October the 1st. Pretty exciting.
Congratulations. And how big or small by whatever metric?
We're in the top 200 contractors in America. Our volume is just under $300 million a year.
Now, you were doing something interesting as a project manager prior to founding Siegel. Why don't you share a little bit of that?
I worked for a big national company called Tishman out of New York back in the started in July 1960. And I was very fortunate to work on some major projects in New York, including Madison Square Garden, Two Penn Plaza, and, of course, the World Trade Center. And when I finished the World Trade Center, I was brought to Washington, D.C. to open up Tishman's office in Washington in 1974.
Wow. Now, when you left Tishman, you had how much money in your pocket to start this company?
We had an awful lot of money. At least we thought at the time. It was $2,214. We thought it was a lot of money.
And
1977.
Why did you found a company? I mean, you were very successful with Tishman. Why start your own company?
And that's a very good point. And I was very happy also. My next assignment was to be in charge of Epcot World for Disney. And Ellen and I decided not to move. We fell in love with Washington. We thought it was great opportunities in Washington, and we decided to go into business together.
So given your previous success, was it easy right from day one?
No, it was not easy at all. It was a very interesting question. Everybody would say to me when I started the business, well, Jerry, you did all these great things when you were Tishman. What did you do for Siegel Construction? And I said, nope, I'm trying to find things. And it took almost 11 months for me to get my first job, which was a small tennis shop in Georgetown, and I did the whole job for $40,000. I was the project manager, the superintendent of constructions, and then I was the labor at 3 o'clock when everybody left, and I put all the rubbish in my trunk, and I went to look for another construction company's container, and I dumped it there.
Oh, my gosh. So obviously, you did not have anything handed to you when you started this company.
No, but I had a great partner.
And then we're going to come back to that.
Yes. You moved to New York, and from New York, and now your wife says after 11 months, what are we doing here? How long have you been married?
Ellen and I met in high school in Brooklyn, Lincoln High School, and we've been married now 47 years. Next month will be our 48th year. And we are we have two adult boys, and we have two grandchildren.
Well, congratulations and happy anniversary. We're going to hear from Ellen shortly. Tell us about life in Brooklyn growing up.
Very interesting. I'm a first-generation American. My father came from Palestine, and my mother came from Poland, and we lived in a four-story tenement walk-up in Brighton Beach, where air conditioning was when you put your mattress on the fire escape. That was what we call air conditioning.
And your first job was when you were 14?
14 years old, because the old ladies, excuse the expression, couldn't get their groceries up in a wire-rim shopping cart because there was no elevator in the four-story tenement walk-up. So I arranged with the six grocery stores to deliver their groceries for 10 cents a bag, and then my guys got tips. And then in the summertime, I'd go and rent beach chairs and buy beach chairs. And the first week, I made back my profit with the beach chairs.
Wow.
So I was doing very well.
So, Jerry, you must have been a star in high school.
No, I was not a star at all because I was a very bad student. I was concentrating on trying to make money and do other things. I was very challenged and very driven because I came from a very poor background.
How did that drive you?
Well, it really goes back to when I had my first pair of Converse sneakers, if you guys remember what Converse sneakers are. And I had a hole in it, and I couldn't buy a new pair of sneakers. I had to put a piece of cardboard in there, and that was what drove me completely.
But we've had other people, your reading and other activities, I think really are a guide to many people who face that. That was never an impediment to you.
Well, what it was to me was that I had an issue. I found out later on when I was 34 years old that I had attention deficit, and I was just driven as an individual to do better and to really, I was the first one in my family to even own a car, first one to go to college. I went to college at night, which was an interesting experience also.
How did you compensate for the attention deficit disorder?
Just a totally challenge with everything I did. I learned completely different, and I just worked very, very hard.
And you know, one of the things we didn't ask up front, it'd be a good time to ask now, given you've just gone over your background. How big or small is Siegel Construction?
We're almost $300 million a year.
Wow.
And we're in the top 200 contractors in America.
Wow, congratulations. Now, you've got somebody sitting next to you, Jerry. This is Ellen, your wife. Ellen, you are the chairperson and founder of Friends of Cancer Research. What is Friends of Cancer Research?
Friends of Cancer Research is a Washington, D.C. based think tank that works with patients, federal agencies on science policy, and our objective is to get better, safer, and more effective treatments to patients.
What is a think tank?
Think tank is a group that publishes, that works on important policy issues, gets consensus, publishes, and then enacts into policy.
And you work with government agencies?
We work with multiple government agencies. We collaborate with the FDA, the NIH. I serve on the Patient-Centered Research Outcome Board that came out of healthcare reform. And we work with patients, academics, pharmaceutical companies.
And you've been doing this for 15 years?
Yes, 15 years. We just had our anniversary.
Congratulations. And why?
Well, it was personal for me. I was a developer in Washington, D.C., and in 1986, my sister, Gail, my younger sister, died at age 40 of breast cancer, leaving a four-year-old child, and it was and is devastating, and I wanted to figure out what can be done to help others.
What was it like for you as her big sister, Gail's big sister, going through that with her?
It was extraordinarily difficult and challenging. Life had not prepared me for the premature loss of a sibling or a family member, and it was awful.
How did you deal with it?
Well, I think you first deal with it first while the patient is alive. When my sister was alive, we tried to get her the best treatment possible. After she died, I decided I can be angry or I can try to make a difference or do something positive for others. But it never leaves me. It's with me every single day.
When did it click in that you were going to found the Friends of Cancer Research?
Well, it was an evolutionary process. I started out at Duke University where my sister was treated, became part of the board, became chair of the board. And then I was a presidential appointee to the National Cancer Advisory Board. And while I was serving on that board as chair of the budget, the idea of the 25th anniversary of the National Cancer Act, and I decided for 1 year I was going to try to help raise public awareness on the importance of biomedical research and cancer research specifically.
You gave up a very successful real estate development career to do this, did you not?
Yes, and it wasn't hard at all.
Well, why not?
Because when you're driven by passion, passion trumps money any day. And if you think you're making a difference and you can help others, it's far more important than dollars.
Have you always been this passionate about the construction business and other businesses?
That's a very good question. The answer is yes, because when we built buildings, I had to have excellent buildings, high quality, good architecture, buildings that were green and that made a difference in people's lives. So the answer is quality has always been important to me.
As a woman in the construction industry, you were one of the few at the time you got into it. Your father had something to do with that, didn't he?
Yes, there were very few. As a matter of fact, there were no owners of development companies in those days. My father always believed that women should and could reach their potential, and there were no limitations. So he was extremely supportive of both my sister and I having careers, being educated, and being independent. It was a value that he encouraged, and obviously my mother was that way as well.
I'd like to go further back and ask what at 15 you saw in Jerry that drew you to this wonderful and long-lasting partnership?
It was just love at first sight. We both had, I had a boyfriend and he had a girlfriend, and we saw one another in a room and there was just immediate chemistry.
Jerry, what would you add to that?
No question about it. It's been fantastic, and it's been wonderful, the two of us, to be together the way we are. And what happens in life is not just are you falling in love. You begin, each of us is each other's best friend. We respect each other. And what's even more amazing, in the last 35 years, our offices have been 10 feet apart from each other. So that tells a lot about our relationship.
My wife told me she loved me, but if I were home every day for lunch, she'd kill me. I mean, how have you managed to balance that constant day-to-day work, plus you're very active, you're very active 24/7.
Because we're separate. We're separate. So even when I was a developer, I had my own company. So we did not, we started for 1 year together, and it was a nightmare. And I discussed, I absolutely did not want to work with Jerry and for him. So when I formed my development company, it was a separate entity. And although it was related, it was separate.
What sort of legacy would you like to leave behind, either through your construction company, through the Friends of Cancer Research? What sort of legacy?
That's really a very good question. We made a very conscious decision not to sell the business years ago, and we decided to give it to the employees, and which is really making a really major difference. So our son and our president of the company and two other people have been with us 27 years are continuing to grow the company. That's one of the things related to construction. Ellen could tell you a lot what she's doing with.
I think the legacy is that we cared and we made a difference in things that we touched in our with one another, our friends, our children, and others, and that we have a responsibility to give back.
Do you think Gail is pleased?
I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address first, Ellen, for the Friends of Cancer Research?
www.focr.org.
FOCR.org.
Yes.
Thank you. And Jerry, the web address for Siegel Construction.
And we're www.sigal.com.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Dr. Ellen Siegel, who is the chairperson and founder of Friends of Cancer Research, and her husband, Jerry Siegel, chairman, owner, and founder of Siegel Construction. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Michael Ancum of Bank of America and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Lori Reed.
Lori, who are you with?
Executive Gift Planners.
What is Executive Gift Planners?
We take all the worry out of you obtaining a holiday gift or a birthday gift or a retirement gift, whatever you need. We take the worry out of that and supply it so you don't have to worry about it anymore.
What is the worry, or what are the worries?
Of like going out to the store to find it or purchasing something that's been in a warehouse for 6 months. We provide fresh, local products to your clients and represent you.
In fact, you said customized when we were talking earlier. What does that mean?
We customize all of our gift baskets. If you have promotional products or need to purchase promotional products, we can include those in the baskets for you, or we can make a basket specifically for if you have a special event coming up, or if you have clients that are coming into town and want just specifically Virginia products, we can do that for you.
Who is a good client or somebody who could use your service?
Just about anyone. We work with a lot of hotels. We work a lot with attorneys. We work a lot with any corporation that needs gifts. And we do a lot with, we also imprint the ribbon at no charge for our clients also.
Can you give us a success story?
I can. We had a client who called us last year for the holidays, and it was towards the end of December, and products were down to nothing, but we were able to pull it off for them. We used our local vendors, and we have a very family-oriented business. And they were able to get the products, and we got the baskets done and delivered for them the next day.
So if someone wants to order some gifts from you, how do they do that?
They can call us, or they can go to www.egpgifts.com.
We've been speaking with Lori Reed of Executive Gift Planners. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Michael Ancuma of Bank of America and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we're pleased to introduce you to our next guest. This is Renee Lewis. Renee is the president and CEO of Pensar Group. Welcome, Renee. And tell us, what is Pensar Group?
Pensar Group is a management consulting firm, and we focus on helping leaders who need to advance their staff in terms of their relationship building skills so that they can increase and grow their business base.
Well, what do you mean by relationship building skills?
It's really interesting. In a lot of services firms, particularly around our area, a lot of folks are not actually trained to develop the relationships that they have, particularly folks in IT industry, CPAs, people who are technically trained. And so we work with these folks who spend a lot of time with their clients and helping them build better relationships, deliver a higher degree of service so that the clients are delighted with the work that they're doing and tend to bring them more work.
Fantastic. How big or small is Pensar Group?
You know, I was thinking about the best way to answer this question. The best way to answer it is, in this area, we've trained over 1,500 participants over the last few years and had some significant impacts in firms, particularly those who have allowed us to work with a broader range of their staff.
Yeah, you talked about 1,500 in this area. You are also international in scope, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we are fortunate. A lot of our clients have remote offices and offices in other regions, and then we've done some other consulting work in the Middle East as well as South Africa.
And you founded the company when, Renee?
The company was actually reinvented in 2007 to focus on an area that my previous company, I couldn't actually find this kind of consulting support when I was running a different company. So when after I sold that company to Cerner, I basically got with my COO and said, you know, hey, why don't we invent the thing we were looking for? And that's when we designed the approach. A lot of this company is based on a lot of IT skills that are reinvented for a business application.
That's pretty ambitious. Is this your first company after that? I mean, have you done just two, or have you done more?
Well, interesting you ask. I've actually worked as a senior exec or key member of 8 different startups at this point. Right now I have the for-profit Pensar Group, and I also have a nonprofit. And then the 6 previous firms were all IT and some sort of a product delivery system.
Can I assume that your mom and dad were entrepreneurs who started multiple companies themselves?
No, my mother was actually a contracts officer for the Air Force, and my father was a dentist. So he's as close to entrepreneurship as I get.
Where did you grow up?
I originally was born in Oklahoma, but when my father went to dental school, we landed in St. Louis, where he went to WashU. And my mother was a GS3 secretary.
And St. Louis, being the Midwest, is it this a hospitable place, nice and warm and bucolic, et cetera?
Well, inner city St. Louis is not hospitable in any way.
Tell us what life was like growing up there.
It was interesting. It was difficult, actually. There was, at the time, many people I'm sure will recall, we had a lot of busing issues and basically shuffling kids around to different schools. And so there's a lot of chaos, quite frankly, at the time. And it was still a very smoggy place, and not like it is today. It's a much nicer city than it was back then.
What were summers like?
Well, summers, I got to go to my grandparents' farm in Oklahoma, where my grandmother ran the largest head of Santa Gertrudis cattle, and my grandfather ran the second largest dairy. So I spent summers riding horses and helping him repair fences, and very different contrast to my St. Louis life.
That's about as contrasting life as I've seen. How did that affect you, or has it affected you in your subsequent career?
It has. I think you gain an insight to looking at contrast better. You can often see things that where some people see them as the same, I can often see them different. Or sometimes when people see them different, I can actually bring them together and see the sameness in them. And so I think my brain challenges the extremes in many ways. And I think a lot of innovation is actually founded in looking at the extremes or the exceptions.
You also mentioned that having this dual existence growing up inculcated you with tolerance. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the extremes that really help you build a tolerance just to life in general, to not be so shocked at something that's different. Often when you grow up in life and you have very little, because quite frankly, we grew up poor, very poor actually. It's finding these sparks out there, these nice differences that are out there that really help you reach for hope. You really have two choices. You can look at the bleakness, or you can look at the spark.
You said you were exceedingly poor, is how you phrased it in the green room. What did that look like in your life?
Well, this is funny. I remember I used to love Campbell's chicken noodle soup, but we couldn't afford it. I know, Campbell's chicken noodle soup. And so one year for my birthday, it was my eighth birthday, my grandmother brought me a case, and I savored the entire case of chicken noodle soup for an entire year.
Wow. You described yourself, and I'm going to use your word, as a volunteer-aholic in high school. What does that mean, number one? And number two, why were you that way?
When I went to high school, we had actually at that point moved to Pennsylvania, which is an interesting journey to get to Pennsylvania. But I was in Pennsylvania, and I think as a lot of my Midwest, I wanted to know people and I wanted to get to know people. And I found in Pennsylvania, you know, everybody had grown up together. It was hard actually to infiltrate. And by getting involved in a lot of different groups and doing things for my high school class, I got to know a lot of different people, and again, I'm really attracted to a lot of variation. And so you get involved in the Latin Club, and you get involved in the, I was a cheerleader, I got involved in organizing homecoming, and organizing the prom, and pretty much anything that came my way, I would organize it.
So with as diverse and as interesting a high school background as you had, what drove you into IT, which for cheerleaders, you're not really looking at IT as a career?
I think, you know, it's interesting. I was kind of a gamer back then. I don't know if you guys remember Centipede and Galaga and all of the games. And I realized that I really had an interest for all of these things. And one of the reasons I got into IT, I actually went to Penn State to be an engineer, a bioengineer. And I found engineering not exceedingly exciting, but I really loved the development, the coding side. I took a graphics course from Mr. Rogers' brother, believe it or not, and found a lot of the design aspects. And engineering is actually a very holistic approach. So instead of being a true engineer, what I did was I took all the computer classes in all of the different schools, because MIS at the time was only in accounting. And so I took all the MIS courses. I took SAS courses and SPSS courses out of the education school. I took simulation out of the business school and any other class I could get my hands on.
Where did you learn how to run a company?
You know, I didn't learn how to run a company at first. I learned how to run software projects. I actually went back to grad school, got a software engineering degree, and I learned more about the systems and the architectures and really how to bring big projects to bear. Then I got a reputation for if anybody needed a project done, call Renee. And because software, you know, we never finish anything.
Right.
So I got a reputation doing that. And over the years, people would give me larger teams, and then I'd take over operations, and then I slid over into the CEO position where I used a lot of the same skill to get things done on budget, on time for companies.
You mentioned in the green room that both the hardest and also your favorite point in running companies was actually shutting one down.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. I was scared to death. I really didn't think I could do it. And we were going through a cycle where the VCs had decided that they were done. And there was no more money coming in, and so we had to make choices. And I had a choice. I could hide it from my staff, or we could all work it together and figure out how we were going to play this out. And to this day, I'm extremely honored that my staff stuck with me until the day we decided to shut it down. And many of them followed me into other companies. And so in the beginning, I was horrified. But once you're rewarded by people who trusted you and came back to you, again, the relationship building piece is a big cornerstone for me. I was just honored that they would come work for me again and trust me that we would go through another hard cycle if that's what it took.
Yeah, tell us about giving up your identity. Those were your words, giving up your identity to start a nonprofit.
It's also Pensara Group. It was my transition once I realized that you can get obsolete in IT. If you're not technically doing it hands-on anymore, you can really obsolete yourself. You can still have an interest in it, but you can be obsolete. And I realized that's not where my skill was anymore. I had developed beyond my IT skill. And the nonprofit, actually, I realized I had a real passion, and my identity was in really unleashing the true economic potential. There are a lot of women out there who are afraid to go off and build businesses. And being a woman in a non-traditional women's field, I was actually able to realize that there are a lot of women out there, and somehow I had gotten through. So how did I get through, and what are we, even locally, missing from all the we have a lot of bio women, we have IT women. There are kinds of women that are afraid to start a company.
Did you have a mentor who guided you?
They've all been men.
Including your grandfather. Tell us about your grandfather.
Especially my grandfather. My grandfather didn't see me as male or female. He knew you could do anything. He had a fourth grade education, and he ran the second largest dairy in Oklahoma at one time.
Wow.
And he brought innovation to the way that he set up his dairy. And so he's always been an inspiration, and he was always encouraging, and he always taught me to see the positive in everything.
And he had some sayings that have stuck with you to this day.
Yeah. Being raised by a Southern Baptist minister, he had a lot of sayings. many of them are... They stick with me. If you see a problem, your job is to figure out how to fix it. And I think being a volunteer, often I get involved because I think I see a solution and able to really do something with it. One of his sayings was, "Your work is, or you can't go play until your work is done," which is fatal as an entrepreneur because your work is never done. So you figure out how to incorporate play into work.
Yeah. What would your granddad think of what you've made of your life and your business career?
Oh, I think he'd be very, very proud of me. I think I don't think he would have predicted it, because I don't think, you know, if you look at some of the path that I've been on through my life, basically, I don't think he would have predicted it, but I think he'd be very proud, because I think he'd see a lot of his own sunshine shining through.
Yeah, good for you. Good for him, too. Would you give us the web address for Pensar Group, please, Renee?
Sure. It's www.pensaregroup.com.
So I've been mispronouncing it. It's not Pensar, it's Pensara.
Yeah, you have to use the hand, Pensare.
Okay.
It's Italian. It means thinking.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Renee Lewis, President and CEO of Pensare Group. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Michael Ancuma of Bank of America and Ed Alera of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is...
Jeff Schreidman.
Jeff, who are you with?
I'm with Reston TechWiz.
And what is Reston TechWiz?
We're a small IT shop based out of Reston. We service IT solutions and internet marketing for the local area.
And so your specialty is what?
Internet marketing websites is our main capability. We're able to analyze people's, you know, internet presence, SEO, and try to get them to the next step.
Yeah, there's a lot of companies out there doing that. What makes you unique?
Well, what we do very well is that we don't sell packages or one-size-fits-all. We're very good at analyzing business requirements and seeing what can actually do a value add for the company and really help boost their leads and things on the web that they want to get to.
Is there something about your background that enables you to do that better than others?
My main degree was finance, and I started in corporate, sort of like a Booz Allen type consulting gig, and what I really saw is that I wasn't giving as much value. So that's when I kind of left that after 5 years and started really building value for the local community and really getting companies to the place they wanted to be.
Can you give us an example or a success story?
Sure. A local company, E-Plus Electric Bikes, we took their website and their internet presence to a new level. They had actually never sold one of their bikes online. We approached them through a contact and told them that they're really missing out on a whole market segment. Since the economy kind of came down, they had downsized a big portion of the company, and we were able to, with the same amount of workers, take their sales up at least twice, and we now see that they are selling global, which they had never done before.
How would someone find out more about you and your company, Jeff?
You can find us on RestonTechWiz.com. You can also find myself, my profile on LinkedIn, and I'd be more than willing to talk to anybody.
We have been speaking with Jeff Schreibman of Reston TechWiz. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Michael Ancuma of the Bank of America and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we are pleased to introduce to you a return guest, Lily Harris, President and CEO of Man Machine Systems Assessment. Welcome back, Lily. And what is Man Machine Systems Assessment?
Man Machine Systems Assessment is a government service firm specializing in the test and evaluation of weapon systems and homeland security and emergency management services.
What is emergency management services and what type of emergencies?
So we provide emergency planning services to federal agencies and universities for any kind of an emergency, any disruption in business, whether it's man-made or a disruption in electricity, loss of key personnel. We help you plan for the worst.
Well, what sort of weapons do you test?
We test ground weapon systems for Department of Army. So we can test anything from a track vehicle to new camouflage to the new headphones that you might be wearing right now.
What about this interests you? Is it the testing of the weapons? Is it the emergency planning? Or is it the running of the business?
It's all the above. I'm really passionate about the citizen-centric focus that we have with our services. I'm very patriotic, so I love that we're helping the warfighters be safe by providing them the most efficient systems. The emergency management piece, the services that we do helps prevent casualties and helps the homeland become secure. Yeah. And the business part, it just really digs into my passion for entrepreneurship.
We'll talk about that in a few minutes. How big or small is your company?
We are right at under 50 employees, and we do about $10 million revenue a year.
And the company was founded when?
In 1990 by Dr. Calvin Harris.
And Dr. Calvin Harris is whom?
He's also my father.
Okay. So tell us about the conversation in the kitchen back in 1990, the family meeting about starting the company.
Sure. So the conversation really started in 1989. My father had retired from the military for about 10 years now. He'd worked for a few different government contracting firms, and he just thought, you know what, I can do this on my own. I'm tired of being a number. I want to create a company that, you know, I'm passionate about and really takes care of its employees. So the conversation started throughout 1989. I remember the specific family meeting we had with whiteboards in the room.
And you were how old?
I was 10 years old at this point.
And this was really a family meeting. This was not your dad saying, okay, this is what I've decided we're going to do.
It was very much a family meeting. My father, he was all in. This was going to be a family venture. Whether or not we worked in the business, he knew that as a family, we were going to commit all of our resources and also understand that he wasn't going to be around 100% because it was going to be 100% in growing this business. So we made the decision as a family, even down to the name. I remember him whiteboarding a bunch of names and us voting on what the company was going to be called.
So did you really have some sort of a say and input at 10 years old, or was your dad just humoring you?
I feel like I did. You know, we all kind of, perhaps my opinion wasn't as loud, but my father is very sensitive to the fact that, you know, I'm not going to be home as much. Is that okay with you? I want to be here as your dad. Is that okay? You know, how are we going to make up for that? So one of the ways that we did that was I helped him on the weekends at work, whether it was filing papers or, you know, helping create a filing system or just hanging out while he was doing his work.
So it sounds to me like you had a very unusual childhood compared to the average person. Is that true or false?
I suppose to the average person. To me, it was very, I had a great childhood. You know, I still played sports. I was very involved in school. It's just on Saturdays, that was the day that I spent with my parents.
So you're an only child. Do you think that contributed to that closeness and then your desire to get into the business?
I'm sure. I was an only child, so I think as an only child you have that unique experience because you spend a lot of time, at least I did, with people, employees and neighbors and whatnot. I was exposed to adults, I guess, at an early age. So I don't know. I was very close with my parents. So
did this have anything to do with you starting a lemonade stand and all of the other things, all the other businesses you started growing up?
Sure. I mean, I was wired. I was all for a business at 10. I mean, before my father started his business, I had my lemonade stand. I made little treats that I would try to sell to the neighborhood kids. I sold gift wrapping paper and chocolate bars, and I was very competitive with sports, and I was just wired that way. So,
yet, growing up, you wanted to be a doctor.
Yes.
Tell us about that vision and how it fits in with everything you've just described.
Well, I wanted to become a doctor. I was very technical as a child, I loved math and science. So becoming a doctor was a way where I could really integrate that passion for science, and then also the entrepreneurial spirit. I wanted to have my own practice, medical practice, where, you know, I'd have my own space and doctors under me. That was always my vision. So, you know, if you look at it, I wanted to be an entrepreneur, whether it was a doctor or a chef or whatever.
Right.
So you're graduating with pre-med, and you've got options, but somehow you went back towards the business, towards the family business?
I did. So I graduated from Texas Tech, pre-med psychology degree, and my options were, the options on the table were to go to culinary school, to go to film school, to join the Peace Corps, or join the family business. And so while I was trying to decide my next move, my parents said, hey, give us a shot. Just come work for us for in the summer. You know, learn the ropes, no strings attached. And that turned into 6 months, 9 months. And hey, we were wanting to open up a DC operation. At this point, we're in El Paso, Texas. Go for 1 year, you know, help us grow that part. So
that's a pretty big jump from El Paso to DC. And you started it yourself? You were the first employee in DC?
So we had a business partner at that point in DC, in Alexandria. So it was running like kind of a home operation. So when I came to DC, we needed to find the office space and make the move from a subcontractor to a prime contractor. At that point, we had only been a subcontractor to one of our competitors, now our competitor. So it was really, I joined the business at a time where we were evolving. We were becoming a prime contractor. We were just got our 8A certification. We just got our first GSA schedule. We just first got our first commercial space. So it was a really exciting time when I joined the business. And that's really what sucked me in. I loved that we were creating, and everything was so new, and we were expanding. And that's what really ignited my love for MSA.
But that's not so easy when it's your parents. They like to see you grow, but isn't there always that natural hesitancy to trust you as a younger person?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a huge challenge for me coming out to DC because of my age. That was a huge constraint. Not only with growing the business and having my parents trust the vision that I had for the business, but also in securing a bank loan and trying to grow the business in a male-dominated industry. There was many challenges.
So in that formative, should I say, growth spurt that the company went through, what did you learn through those experiences, securing your GSA schedule, your first prime contract, winning your award, getting a bank, starting to feel like you were moving it from, should I say, a mom and pop,
yep,
into a real business? What were some of the lessons that you took away from that have helped you grow the company since?
Some of the lessons I had was to really have a vision so that you're moving forward. And you have to have perseverance, because it is hard. It is very hard, and you need to trust that you're moving in the right direction and not give up.
You have been the president for 4 years.
Yes.
And the CEO for 1 year.
Yes.
And you were how old?
32.
Okay. How did you I'm not going to make that assumption. Was there skepticism among
Yes.
people in the company?
Absolutely.
And how did you win them over? The skeptics?
By doing my job, by not letting it affect me, and just keeping moving forward, making the right decisions, moving the company in the right direction. So I really let my job do the speaking for me.
What sort of vision do you have for the company
moving forward?
Yeah.
So definitely we want to grow. I've spent the last few years professionalizing the business. Every policy, every process that I put in place is forward thinking, so that way we can we're ready for that growth. But my vision for the company, my dream, is to announce my retirement at our 50th year anniversary.
Wow, that is exciting. And that is a very concrete vision. I'm very impressed. Lily, give us the web address for Man-Machine Systems Assessment.
Our web address is www.msaincorp.com.
Yeah, I want you to give it to us one more time. I don't want anyone to miss it.
Okay, www.msaincorp.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Lily Harris. Lily is the president and the CEO of Man-Machine Systems Assessment. I'd like to thank my two co-hosts, Ed Alera of Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and Michael Ancum of the Bank of America for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is...
Lori Reed.
Lori, who are you with?
Executive Gift Planners.
What is Executive Gift Planners?
We take all the worry out of you obtaining a holiday gift or a birthday gift or a retirement gift, whatever you need. We take the worry out of that and supply it so you don't have to worry about it anymore.
What is the worry, or what are the worries?
Of like going out to the store to find it or purchasing something that's been in a warehouse for 6 months. We provide fresh, local products to your clients and represent you.
In fact, you said customized when we were talking earlier. What does that mean?
We customize all of our gift baskets. If you have promotional products or need to purchase promotional products, we can include those in the baskets for you, or we can make a basket specifically for if you have a special event coming up, or if you have clients that are coming into town and want just specifically Virginia products, we can do that for you.
Who is a good client or somebody who could use your service?
Just about anyone. We work with a lot of hotels. We work a lot with attorneys. We work a lot with any corporation that needs gifts. And we do a lot with, we also imprint the ribbon at no charge for our clients also.
Can you give us a success story?
I can. We had a client who called us last year for the holidays, and it was towards the end of December, and products were down to nothing, but we were able to pull it off for them. We used our local vendors, and we have a very family-oriented business. And they were able to get the products, and we got the baskets done and delivered for them the next day.
So if someone wants to order some gifts from you, how do they do that?
They can call us, or they can go to www.egpgifts.com.
We've been speaking with Lori Reed of Executive Gift Planners. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Michael Ancuma of Bank of America and Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems, and it's our pleasure to introduce to you our final guest, a gentleman by the name of Sonu Singh. Sonu is the founder and CEO of 1901 Group. Welcome, Sonu, and tell us, what is 1901 Group?
Thanks, Michael. 1901 Group is a company that manages IT infrastructure, whether it's network, security, or applications, for a wide variety of clients, banks, federal government, state and local government. The only difference is we do all the work out of Blacksburg, Virginia.
And we're going to find out why in a moment. Tell us how big or how small by whatever measure.
We have about 30 customers, 50 employees, and we should do about $8 million in revenue this year.
And one of your customers is Arizona State University. Tell us a little bit about that example.
So what we do for Arizona State University is we manage their networks, their voice system, some of their security, and their wireless access points, but we do it all out of Blacksburg in a 24/7 manner.
Why Blacksburg?
Well, really three reasons. There was great access to talent because of the university, great quality of life, and a reasonable cost of living as compared to more urban areas. And the fourth probably overriding reason is I'm from Blacksburg.
So, you know, I thought to myself when I asked the question, why Blacksburg, there's a large portion of our listening audience that say, what are you, an idiot? What do you mean, why Blacksburg? Don't you know? So tell us, what was it like growing up in Blacksburg?
You know, I always tell people that, you know, I didn't think my life could get any better in high school growing up in Blacksburg until I went to college in Blacksburg, which was high school without my parents. It was great. It was a unique community in that there's probably a third of the community was around revolved around the university. Another third were local business people, and another third were just folks that happened to work in the area. So it was a great mishmash of people,
including a large population of people from India.
Not when we got there. Well, I like to say that we were the first settlers, and we came on covered wagons. But The reality is when my family showed up in 1977 or 1978, we were the first Indians in the community. And they used to ask me what tribe I was from.
What was that like?
I'd grown up in Illinois and gone to a school which was not very diverse. So moving to Blacksburg was slightly more diversity, but not that much more at the time. But everybody in the community, for those people who have lived there and grown up there, it's a remarkably accepting community. And you know, honestly, I had a fabulous time growing up there.
What did your parents do there?
My parents are both professors at Virginia Tech.
And your dad was a professor of earthquake engineering, I think is what you called it. What does that mean?
He's in the engineering science and mechanics department, but his specialty is earthquake engineering, how to build structures that would withstand earthquakes or tsunamis or windstorms, whatever, stuff like that.
Did you always know that you were going to be in the technology business? Did you think at one point in time you would follow your parents in academia?
Well, probably not in academia. I mean, you could tell by my GPA that wasn't going to be a long career path for me. So, I technology is something that kind of happened to me. When I was in school, I worked on a shop floor, and that gave me a lot of, confidence in my ability to deal with different types of people, and also an interest in manufacturing. After graduation, I worked for Ernst & Young. But I only worked on manufacturing projects.
To tell us more about working on the shop floor in a manufacturing facility, especially as contrasted with your parents and their circle of friends who were all academics.
It was a fabulous experience, probably one of the defining experiences in my life, to go from being in predominantly an academic environment in a university to working at essentially a federal mogul plant outside of Blacksburg that made engine bearings. And I worked on the shop floor, and I worked with folks that were in the United Auto Workers Union. I worked with foremen. I worked with schedulers. I was actually a scheduler of an area. And it's a great learning experience. I happened to learn how to get along with different types of people at different levels.
Yeah, so to sort of set that stage, I'm guessing there were not a lot of college students on the shop floor.
None.
Not a lot of academics.
None.
Not a lot of Indians.
None.
Okay.
Over three.
Yet this was a fantastic place for you to be. Why?
It was very interesting. As I said, for those of people who have grown up or lived or been to Blacksburg, it is a remarkably warm community. And working on the shop floor, I was predominantly working with guys that were probably two or three times my age. I was 18 years old. They certainly weren't Indian unless they were Cherokee or Seminole or something. I was a young college student working there. And they took me under their wing. They taught me everything they knew about manufacturing. No biases. It was a fabulous learning experience.
Well, the entrepreneurship thing seems to be, seems to run through your blood. Can you tell us about it? You've sold two other companies. You're on your third, I believe. You were selling Cokes. Tell us about it at that young age.
Well, yeah, I always, my dad used to always tell me that working built character. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I became a character because I had to work so much. But I worked from a very young age, and then when I got out of school and started my professional career, I realized that a very large organization probably isn't for me. So I started figuring out what the market would want in terms of technology services companies. And I've been very lucky, and certainly not just because of me. I was able to get the right people around me, and the companies did very well and grew, and I ended up selling them.
So actually, your first gig, so to speak, was your version of the corner lemonade stand in sixth grade.
Yes.
And I emphasize your version of
yes.
it. Let's hear your version
yes.
of it.
Yes. In the sixth grade, I started selling Cokes at Virginia Tech football games. So I was the guy that everybody yells at to get up here and give them a Coke. The only thing I saw is a unique market niche to rebrand soft drinks and Coke as mixers. The student body seemed to love it, and when I was fortunate enough to get on the east side to sell Cokes, I did very well. I could make $30, $40 a game, and for a sixth grader, I was really rolling in money at that point.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about working with Blacksburg. I mean, this is an area that maybe you don't think about technology as a strength in the workforce. So you have an opportunity to sort of like transform that workforce a little bit through some of the work you're doing.
Well, one of the big moments in my life was looking at when I worked on the shop floor and seeing kind of very good middle class jobs and middle class lives. And I believe, in my opinion, over the last 20 years, that's changed. A lot of those jobs have left. So my concept around the current company was, how can we create a whole new wave of middle-class jobs? And those jobs would be managing the IT infrastructure of the nation, of private sector, public sector, in a way that's very much like an assembly line. The reason I named the company 1901 is that was the year the assembly line was created. So these are people that we've hired people out of Virginia Tech. I've also asked my folks to hire people out of the community college system, the local technical school, just to see how we can get folks into early technology jobs, train them to manage infrastructure, and then bring them up the career path.
How is Blacksburg different because of what you're doing there?
Well, I mean, we're in our very early stages, but I think we're in the Corporate Research Center, and they've been, I think, pretty pleased with our growth there. We started 2 years ago. We've hired over 30 people in Blacksburg. Our jobs typically provide a median income, an income that's higher than the median income in the area, so everybody's a consumer. And it's a very good place to live and grow. And from my perspective, I think Blacksburg is better off because I think we can drive a lot of talent there, as well as retain the amount of talent that, rather than leaving the area and going up to Northern Virginia and going to Charlotte and going to New Jersey, they can stay in the area and grow the economy in the area.
Is this a model that other small rural university towns could follow to raise the level of the economy?
I think so. I think that when I first put together the plan for this, we call it the IT factory, and the goal was to put 50 IT factories, one in each state, in a rural town anchored by a major university. And the theory was that we could, since we can drive down the cost of managing your IT infrastructure, which is essentially 80% of your IT spend, not only would this create good jobs, but it'd also free up capital to do more interesting IT projects.
Are your parents surprised by the success you've had, and also are they surprised at what a visionary you are?
Well, visionary, overused term, but especially as it relates to me. I don't think they're surprised. I think they always knew that I was, fairly, unique in my view of certain things. There's plenty of stories that they can tell you that would lead you to believe that they're very surprised that I'm successful and not mowing lawns for a living, which I did that too. I think it's really the way they kind of raised me, is with high expectations. At the same time, sometimes my dad used to always tell me that the harder you work, the luckier you get. So I've gotten lucky a couple times.
In the green room, and we only have a few seconds for this answer, but in the green room, you praised how smart your sisters are. What do your sisters think of their brother today?
They think I'm a pretty generous guy. That's about it. They think I'm smart, but certainly not as academically smart as they are.
Would you give us the web address, please, for 1901 Group?
It's www.1901group.com.
Simple. We've been speaking with Sonu Singh, founder and CEO of 1901 Group. I'd like to thank all of our guests today. Dr. Ellen Siegel, chairperson and founder of Friends of Cancer Research. Jerry Siegel, chairman, owner, and founder of Siegel Construction. Renee Lewis, president and CEO of Pensare Group. And, of course, most recently, Sonu Singh, founder and CEO of 1901 Group. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, Michael Ancuma of Bank of America, and Phil Horegi of Saber Systems for helping me with the interview. More than anything else, I'd like to thank our audience. If it were not for you, we would not even have a radio show. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. Thank you to the Fairfax Chamber of Commerce for hosting us today. This has been your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.